and welcome to Fidelity Connects by Fidelity Investments Canada, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Portfolio manager Sam Holiak shares his outlook on opportunities in emerging markets and what to expect in 2021. Sam manages the Fidelity's Emerging Markets Fund, and he said this year was a great landscape for EM. However, it caused a huge fire sale on pro-cyclical companies. This could cause a vicious cycle as denominated debt is no less expensive to pay back. For example, Africa and South Africa have a lot of US dollar debt. Sam comments on the year that was. Many investors are worried as the pandemic grows all over the world, but he stresses that we must get through it and focus on the light at the end of the tunnel. As a vaccine comes into play, he points out that emerging markets will be a little behind. It probably won't be until the summer until a vaccine reaches EM countries. Interestingly, he says India will come out of this pandemic with a lot of growth. It is still in the early stages, but Sam is confident that in the next year, India will be a great place for growth. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets is frequently changing. Today's podcast was recorded on December 17, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada, ULC, or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Sam, I'll begin a little bit with, I think we saw a performance slide. We might put it back up in a second. Your performance has been rather incredible. What phase of reallocation to EM are we in here? I mean, give us sort of there's an awakening going on, it seems like.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think we're still early phases because, I mean, we basically have had 10 years of underperformance for the asset class that's been brought on by, you know, some difficulties country by country. Also, we've had a period of very strong dollar, which we could talk about more later. And so both those things have really weighed on the asset class. And now coming out of this crisis, as you know, emerging markets places in Asia, places like China, have been the first to come out of the COVID crisis in a much stronger position. And so that's really helped the asset class a fair amount. And, you know, plus this year, performance-wise, we got a fat pitch. You don't get a fat pitch every day, but we really got one during the crisis where a lot of folks were concerned about the pandemic and the effect that it was going to have on global growth. And it has had an effect on global growth. But the point being is it was temporary. And we had a huge fire sale at the start of the year, which I was able to take advantage of, on pro-cyclical companies that were just really beaten up during the downturn. And so that's a big reason for the outperformance.
You know, the global asset allocation experts at Fidelity, they've allocated, I'm just looking through these numbers, about 10% to EM in the Fidelity Global Balanced Portfolio, which is a strategic mix of 60% equities. And then in the more aggressive Fidelity Global Growth Portfolio, which is 85% equity, they've allocated about 12%. So you can see sort of these allocations moving up, taking up more significant areas. Let's talk about the role of the US dollar. I mean, it really, to an extent, the answer to the EM why now is the US dollar, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. It can become a vicious cycle into a virtuous circle, because the vicious cycle was the past 10 years where you had a period of stronger dollar. And what does a stronger dollar mean? It means weaker currencies in emerging markets. And weaker currencies in emerging markets have a big side effect because these countries have to defend their purchasing power. So they have to hike interest rates to protect their currencies. And so when they hike interest rates, that really hurts growth and hurts consumption. And so those effects have really been in place for a decade. And so you have a lot of pent-up demand now in a lot of these countries, not just Asia, but all of emerging markets, that could really come through if we go through this period of a weakening dollar, which I believe we're at the early phases of.
I mean, their dollar-denominated debt is cheaper to repay. I mean, that's sort of, they've got some room. Is that And that's a big piece of the picture.
That's definitely a big part of it. Not all countries have a lot of dollar-denominated debt. The dollar-denominated debt are mostly in Latin America and Africa. Most of the other countries have their own local currency debts, and so it's less of a factor. But the strong dollar, in terms of being having to protect their currencies, definitely is a factor. And I think that's a big driving factor that should allow this kind of this vicious cycle that I mentioned to become this virtuous circle.
Much of where you're looking is in Asia. Give us sort of the geographical general one, two, threes.
So when I came into emerging markets, it was roughly 50-50 between Asia and the rest of emerging markets, which is Latin America and emerging Europe, Middle East, and Africa. Today it's about 80-20, and a lot of it has had to do with really good innovative companies that have come up in Asia. And so in places like China, Taiwan, Korea, you have companies like Samsung. We're leaders in memory and smartphones. Taiwan Semiconductor, we're leader in fabs for semi manufacturing semiconductors. Intel had to give up because Taiwan Semiconductor was so strong. You have companies like Tencent, Alibaba, Meituan in China, Mercado Libre in Latin America, Yandex in Russia, just really good companies that are just really well managed and have done really well. And so it's been a big reason why emerging markets have this new leg of growth with these innovative companies as the countries, especially places like China, that have really invested in research and development and internet and embracing new technologies to really help them grow.
It's been fascinating to watch, so much of the news flow around China equities opening up, sort of their capital markets generally opening up. There are a lot of new opportunities within that. I mean, I'm just going to ask one of the obvious questions, sort of the headlines of Ant Financial or, the IPO market. Do you see froth in there? Is it overdone? Give us some context for how you're looking at the markets there.
So there's definitely some froth. I mean, you have some companies that where earnings aren't going to come through for 5 to 10 years. They're trading at 10, 20, 30 times sales. So that froth is definitely there. You have SPACs. I think more than half of IPOs that have come have been SPACs, which are these specialty vehicles that don't really have a business. They just have an individual that promises to buy an asset. So those are all signs of frothiness, but I don't think we're anywhere near where we were in 99, the ultimate frothiness, whereby you have real businesses that are making real earnings. We could debate on what multiple you pay for them, but I think you have some really good companies that are doing a really great job. And so within emerging markets, comparable companies in the developed market are much more expensive than they are in EM. And so that's another big reason why I see the opportunity.
Sam, how do you do your research? I mean, you're in the US. How do you make sure you have a real depth of knowledge around these companies?
So before the pandemic, I would do a lot of traveling, and I have 20 over 20 years of experience that has helped me because I've been to these places and met a lot of the senior folks at companies. But being at Fidelity, we have a huge global company. We have offices in Hong Kong, in London, and we have people on the ground there that really are good at and speak different languages that are really good at being on top of things. So we talk to them regularly. And so with the pandemic, I was really worried whether we'd be able to stay on top of these businesses. But it's actually worked out great because in the past, we'd wait for companies to come visit us and be in Fidelity. A lot of them would just come by our offices, either in Hong Kong, London, or Boston, and we'd be able to meet them that way. But now, through Zoom mostly, WebEx a little bit, we can actually go through and have a lot of calls and meetings at all hours. So my day begins very early. I usually start between 5 and 6 a.m. and get a lot of work done while some of the markets are still open. And then, my day kind of slows down during midday. And then after, I have dinner with my family, I have a lot of calls. Most nights I have a call at like 8 or 9 o'clock with an Asian company. It's morning their time. And it's worked out really well because before a lot of senior folks saw it as kind of a waste of time to come visit us and have a meeting. Now they see it as an opportunity. It's just a few minute, just turning on the Zoom call. They get on for either a full hour or a half hour or something like that, and we get really good insight. And that's why it's been terrific. Our whole team has really benefited from that.
I'll have to ask you how you mastered the art of cat naps at some point, because it sounds like you'd have to employ such a strategy throughout throughout your day. Let's talk a little bit about where we are right now. We are seeing, I mean, stock markets obviously are surging. They're hitting all-time highs. There's a big vaccine trade that's been going on for over a month. What do you see in the short term, and what do you see in sort of the midterm?
Thanks, Pamela. I really look at this as the analogy with what happened during World War II. The news on the vaccine is, in my opinion, is the equivalent of what happened with D-Day, where the Allies have landed. You know, it's only a limited time where the Nazis and their allies stay in control, but you still have are kind of stuck with them until the Allies liberate you. And so this is the situation that we're in today, where a lot of folks are still worried because we have the pandemic ravaging the world, and a lot of times in terms of new infections and deaths are hitting all-time highs. But we have to just get through this because we see the light at the end of the tunnel, and that light is going to be huge because there's a lot of pent-up demand out there in the developed world and the emerging world. Folks that want to go on a trip, folks that want to go out to eat, folks that want to spend money where, not everyone has it, but a lot of folks have been able to save a lot of money and pay down a lot of their debt during this crisis where they haven't been spending as much. And so you're going to have this boom, in my opinion, that's going to come through second half of next year and into 22, that's going to carry emerging markets to new highs and most global markets. And that's why the stock market is doing is what it is because I think a lot of folks are anticipating this boom that's coming.
What is the vaccine rollout plan broadly across the countries that we don't hear about as much? We seem to know bit by bit what's going on in the UK and what's going on. But I mean, are emerging markets set to do this rollout?
Yeah, so emerging markets are a little bit behind. I mean, they have some of their own vaccines. You have, China has their own vaccine, which is being rolled out. In theory, Russia has their own vaccine, although today President Putin came out and said that he's not taking the vaccine himself. It's kind of sets a bad example for Russia. But I think all of these vaccines have reached agreements. So whether it's Pfizer or Moderna, they've reached agreements as well, whereby those vaccines might not be the first, they might not be the first to see them, but they will see them going into the summer, where most Americans, unless you're a risk group, probably won't see a vaccine. I assume it's the same in Canada. Won't see the vaccine until probably May, maybe starting in April. And so we'll get kind of full vaccination by late summer. So my guess is emerging markets will probably be 2 months after that. And so you're going to see some of those emerging markets coming through by the third quarter of next year. And so but then the growth will be, the US will get that little first growth coming through, but then afterwards you're going to get emerging markets coming through with that next leg of growth.
So interesting, just sort of the timing and where you get ready to catch some of this upswing. Some of the upswing is going to be people, doing things like they've been, it's pent up demand. They put off buying, cars, motorbikes. I mean, all these kinds of things. We hear a lot about EVs. How does sort of the EV auto trend work, and how is it one of the ones you're playing? I believe we talked about that last time.
I do have a few stocks that benefit from the EV trend. There are other trends that I think are as prominent, if not more prominent than EV, because the tricky part with EV is that it's tough to build the infrastructure. In the US, it's a little bit easier. Everyone parks their car in their garage. A lot of people do. And so you can basically build a thing for a charger for it overnight. But imagine if you live in China and most people don't have a parking spot because they live in high rises in the big cities. You don't really have a place to charge. And the government's trying to do this rollout. So I think the EV story will happen, but because of infrastructure, because it takes time to charge the cars, it just might take a little bit longer than folks would expect. So some of the themes that I like that I think are much more kind of faster themes are one is 5G. I think there's going to be a lot of benefits from 5G. A lot of folks are going to be upgrading because you're basically not going to need to have a Wi-Fi network in your home because your phone or whatever you can connect your iPad or what computers onto the network will have just as good a speed as your Wi-Fi connections. It'll also mean huge implications for things like Internet of Things. So your freezer talks to your washing machine, talks to your phone. Everything becomes much more connected. Cars, it'll really enable ADAS, and so that you'll have cars being able to drive themselves much more quickly because the cars will communicate to each other to avoid crashes. You need 5G for that to really happen. So I think 5G is a big theme. Automation is another big theme. Post-crisis, people feel much better about working next to a robot rather than working next to another person. And so I think that coupled with higher wages will mean a lot more companies. It has meant a lot more companies have spent a lot more on robots. And I think that theme will continue. E-commerce, infrastructure, consumption, because of this pent-up demand that I told you before about. I think those are the themes that are going to be driving EM probably for the next 5 years, probably five to 10.
I'll just ask you on banking. There's a lot of questions rolling in, so we're going to get to all of those. On banking broadly, I mean, it's been a rough go with interest rates where they are, but there are other subtleties that obviously are affecting banks across EM. How do you look at the financial sector?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think financial sector's been in the dumps for a long time, where it used to trade, most banks in EM traded at 1 to 2 times book value previously based on expectations for return on equity and profitability. They've all derated. You have Korean Chinese banks that are trading at half a book value or a quarter of book value. And I think some of it had to do with tough margin compression. But I think if rates come up, that margin compression becomes to kind of margin accretion. And then all of a sudden, ROEs start to come back and the banks maybe start to re-rate closer to book value. And so I've actually been a buyer of banks on the margin. It's not one of the big themes, but I've been underweight banks and now I've closed that underweight a fair amount.
A number of questions coming in here. One, you touched on certainly it has to do with valuations, valuations in developed markets versus valuations in emerging markets. A couple of thoughts on there. You've touched on it, but this investor would like to know the
Sure,
comparison.
it's a great question. So two things on valuation. One is on you got to look. You can't just look at valuation in a vacuum. You got to look at valuation relative to growth. And so the U.S. trades at a premium. I think it's like 18 times or something like that, maybe 19 times. Emerging markets are closer to 12. And so, but the growth in the U.S. had been better. But now emerging market, especially with a weaker dollar, meaning stronger emerging market currencies. You have the prospects for actually better growth in emerging markets. It's kind of like the operating leverage where the companies, and what you're seeing is in the US, companies have done a great job cutting costs because a lot of folks were worried, a lot of companies, executives that I talked to were really worried that we're going to have a 2008 type of crisis coming out of this. And so they cut costs aggressively. And so because of that, the market totally underestimated how much they were able to cut costs. And so when revenues did not collapse, but the costs came down, so they had huge margin expansion. So I track how many of my companies that I own actually beat earnings versus expectations in the last 2 quarters. And historically, it's been around 55 to 60% of the companies I own would beating earnings. In the last 2 quarters, it's been closer to 80%,
Wow.
just because they've been so aggressive on costs. And I think costs will start to come back because they deferred a lot of costs and they furloughed people. Deferred CapEx, things like that. That's all will come back next year, but it won't be to the level a lot of folks expect. And that's why I think that growth, both in terms of profitability and revenue, should continue in emerging markets.
I want to talk about India and your thoughts on the economy, which of course is being absolutely ravaged by the COVID-19 pandemic. But just sort of fitting some of the banking discussions in there that you've already mentioned, because I mean, there have been huge financial sort of regulations that have been blanketing the country over the course of the last sort of half decade. It's how do you look at India generally, but also specifically on the financial side?
I think you hit the nail on the head, Pamela. Financials have been the reason why India struggled so much. You had a lot of these non-bank financial institutions that had overexpanded in India coming out of the last crisis. And so they were basically replacing the banks, but they were lending to companies that weren't in the strongest position, mostly real estate companies. and they got into a difficulty. And so these non-bank financial institution got into a tough time, and the government's been forced to kind of wind them down, sell off some of the assets, and a lot of that's played out. That's been going on the last 3, 4 years. India's also been hurt because the government, President Modi, been very aggressive in terms of reforms. And so he's rolled out reforms in terms of taxes, the GST, demonetization, getting rid of currencies that were, a lot of them were for black market transactions. And it has had huge negative effects on growth because it's really decreased the size of the gray economy, because both taxes, forcing more companies to pay taxes, financial inclusion, things like that, and demonetization has hurt the black market companies that were just kind of not paying taxes. And but unfortunately, they employ a lot of people, so you've had employment under pressure. But now that's all played out, because that's been over the last 5 years. And now, coming out of this pandemic shutdown, you're going to actually have decent growth coming through on India, and a lot of the banking crisis that they had been seeing have kind of played out. And now you're actually going to, it's early stages. It might not come through in the next quarter or two, but I'm confident in the next year or two, India will be a place that's real interesting for growth. In terms of background, I was overexposed to India for about 15 years. And about 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, I actually went negative India and underweight India relative to my benchmark, and for the concerns you laid out correctly, Pamela. And just over the last month or two, I'm warming up to India much more, and I've been increasing my exposure there.
Is that one of the benefits? I mean, it strikes me as one of the benefits of running the EM fund. You can sort of move from an area into another area, because otherwise the question sometimes is, why not just buy Asia, take a look at, but I guess this allows you to catch things on the upswing and move things around if you can see it. Is that
So
right?
you bring up a great point. Earlier this year, when the crisis first hit, I was overexposed to China. I had bought more China at the start of the year, because you recall that the pandemic started in China, and so the Chinese market sold off aggressively, and I had bought into that. And so when the crisis hit, a lot of the stocks, my overexposure to China really helped. But then, when a lot of other stuff got cheaper, I actually sold down China. And because China's handled the pandemic so well, I'm underexposed to China today relative to the past, where last year I was way overexposed to, or at the start of this year, I was way overexposed to China. Even though China's a great market, great companies, but on the margin, I see more upside in places like Latin America today, that were really ravaged by this crisis, and have a lot more operating leverage at the company level coming out of it.
Layer on top, sort of the sensitivities around global trade, sensitivities that might provide opportunity because they're sort of at the forefront, countries that are ready to take a bit of an upswing. There are blockages to trade. We've seen a new partnership across Asia, the RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic, I think, partnership, encompassing
Well
all
done.
Asian countries. Yeah, did I get that? And but then you also have sort of TPP in the background. So I'm just curious how all the trade machinations you watch for your own purposes.
So the TPP, when people look back at what happened the last 10 years, the scuttling of TPP will be looked at as kind of a watershed moment, because this wasn't something that had done was set up by the previous regime in the U.S. That was going to basically link the U.S. to a lot of Asia and be able to kind of be a great counterbalance for growth, be able to build this kind of lower trade barriers and really help growth. Scuttling of that really hurt, and now Asian countries did their own RCEP, as you rightly pointed out, Pamela. That is an offset to TPP, so the U.S. has been left out of that, and so I think it'll be very difficult for the Biden regime to try to rekindle the TPP, because in the old days, if you back up 20 years, most Asian trades. I was just looking at Korea earlier this morning. Korea, back in 2000, more than half their trade was, I think 60% of their trade was with the U.S. And the rest of Asia was like 20, 30%. Now it's reverse. Asia's like 60, 70%, and the U.S. is at 20. So they don't need us as much as they once did. And the TPP was a great opportunity to move that forward, to have the U.S. engaged with Asia. But I think it'll be difficult to rebuild that now. But I'm hopeful that the Biden regime will try. I think they will.
To sort of put parts of it back together. Some questions coming in about specific countries, for instance. So do you cover Vietnam? Is that an area of interest for you?
So Vietnam is a real interesting market that's very fast growing, but it falls into the frontier category. There really aren't that many investable companies. While it's a great market that's doing extremely well in terms of taking some outsourcing share from China, it's really hard to find liquidity to be able to invest there. And so I leave that to folks that invest in frontier.
Okay. Some questions coming in on, how, again, going back to how do you trust the numbers coming out of certain countries? I wonder if you can almost provide an example. I think you and I talked about a coffee example, but how do you use the research to avoid, huge downfall potential?
One of the big advantages we have at Fidelity is, and I've worked at a few shops outside and I've never seen anything like this, is we deploy capital to things that help our investors that's really hard to quantify. And one of those things is we have a team in Bangalore in India and in Hong Kong that just focuses on corporate governance. And by corporate governance, I don't just mean going through the finances of companies, which they do, and going through the financial statements and make sure everything adds up and the company's doing the right thing, but also means doing background checks on the individuals behind these companies and whether they've been difficult to work with before, whether they've cheated minorities before, that sort of stuff. And they give ratings for us, which are extremely helpful.
I know no one likes to talk about currencies, but let's talk about currencies. So the Canadian currency is what it is. We've often compared it to the US. It's actually doing well because we have a declining US dollar. And to an extent, I think people understand that dynamic. It's the exposure to companies that are listed in other currencies. What benefit is there for a Canadian investor, investor in a lot of countries, but specifically here?
Yeah, I mean it's great diversification. I mean the Canadian dollar's done has p had periods where it almost went to parity with the U.S. dollar, and then it went from, as you and I joked before, about going from a loonie to a toonie
Yeah.
when it devalued by a lot as well. So in that sense, it has some similarities to emerging markets, and a weaker dollar, which I believe will happen, will benefit Canadian investors and will benefit Canadian assets. But I think emerging markets, personally, I'm biased, but I think they'll benefit more because there's a lot more pent-up demand. In Canada, you've had a good cycle that's been very much linked to the US, so I don't think there's as much pent-up demand versus a place like Brazil that's really been in a recession or quasi-recession now for 7, 8 years. And so it's just not comparable in that sense.
It's fascinating. There's so many pieces that we need to come back to clearly throughout the year that unfolds because so many of these pieces are. I mean, is it fair to say it is early days, just as kind of a final thought? Like, is this a rotation to EM that is in early days at this stage, or, is the boat starting to leave, or where do you see this?
I believe so. I've seen a few EM cycles. I mean, EM had a huge cycle in the early 90s. They were brought down when the US started hiking rates in 94. And then, as I mentioned earlier, about the late 90s with the strong dollar period that brought on the Asia crisis. In the mid 2000s, EM had a huge cycle coming out of post 2003 and the weaker period of dollar that kind of ended in the global financial crisis. I'm hopeful now, because we've had these 10 tough years, that this is really the early stages. I mean, you look at how much EM has underperformed developed markets over that period, especially the US. I think there is a nice catch-up trade because we've had good GDP growth, mostly led by Asia, but we haven't really had great stock market performance. And I think that's we're in this early period where I think coming out of this growth, coming out of this crisis, we'll really see that acceleration.
Sam Poliak, I really want to thank you for joining us and taking us through some of the threads of this story. Fascinating. Thanks for joining us.
You bet, Pamela. That's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. Please visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.